From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now, and it's a Friday in August, so that means another lurch in the presidential campaigns. And sure enough, today, Paul Manafort, chair of the Trump campaign, resigned. On Wednesday, Steve Bannon, executive chair of Breitbart News, was named chief executive of the campaign, and there was speculation then that Manafort was being pushed toward the exit. Meanwhile, Trump and his VP, Mike Pence, are in Louisiana today after those devastating floods in Baton Rouge. Democratic Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards says he welcomes the visit, but he also says he hopes it's not a photo op. President Obama and Secretary Clinton have yet to make a trip, and they've drawn some criticism for that. And with that, let's hear the jingle.
Here and now, 2016.
Always so hopeful. Joining us for our weekly wrap-up on the 2016 election, Margaret Talov, senior White House correspondent at Bloomberg News. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. And you've been covering the Clinton campaign, so we'll hear from you. And Jesse Holland, race and ethnicity writer at the Associated Press. Hi, Jesse.
How are you doing today?
I'm good. And we want to start with Paul Manafort out after Steve Bannon was brought in. There had been criticisms of Manafort's ties with Russia. Steve Bannon considered even more of a pit bull than Manafort is. So, Jesse, start with you. What do you see in these changes?
Well, Paul Manafort almost didn't have a choice to leave the Trump campaign at this point. Some great work by some of my colleagues, Jeff Horwitz and Chad Day. AP ran a story yesterday showing that Manafort had been behind a covert influence campaign in the United States for the Ukrainian then-ruling party. And that brings up all types of questions that a presidential candidate doesn't want to deal with in the middle of a presidential campaign.
Yeah, we spoke about this on the air, and we wondered if there were going to be shoes to drop after this. What your AP investigation found is that there was a secret ledger, but also that was the New York Times reporting, but that money had been siphoned, and this is, again, according to AP, money had been siphoned to Paul Manafort to siphon it on to lobbyists in Washington.
Right. So, once again, regardless of how that shakes out, this is something that Donald Trump doesn't need right now. His campaign has been controversial enough on its own. The last thing you want is have your campaign manager being the headline of news stories. So it was just a matter of time before Paul Manafort had to go, and they decided to rip the Band-Aid off sooner than later.
Yeah.
Well, after all these shakeups, already we're hearing some changes in Trump's tone. Here he is last night at a rally in Charlotte, North Carolina, expressing some regret at some of the things he said in the past.
Sometimes in the heat of debate and speaking on a multitude of issues, you don't choose the right words or you say the wrong thing. I have done that.
Now, Margaret, Kellyanne Conway, the new campaign manager, said that was all Donald Trump. But I mean, what do you think about her influence on this campaign going forward? Are we going to see more of this from Donald Trump?
I think that was all Kellyanne Conway and Steve Bannon. look, I mean, here's the deal, right? Paul Manafort. Yeah. Does Paul Manafort, through his lobbying career and his ties to pro-Russian forces in Ukraine politics and business, was that always a liability for Donald Trump? Sure. Absolutely it was. But did Donald Trump do himself grievous damage right after that small bump out of the Republican convention by going after the Kahn family at the Democratic National Convention? And did his numbers then plummet? And did Hillary Clinton start leading every national poll since then? Has she been ahead since roughly July 23rd or something like that? Yes. So this is an effort to as much to take attention away from Paul Manafort, Russia and Ukraine, as much as that is in an effort to kind of stanch the bleeding that Donald Trump has brought upon himself,
but Margaret,
and turned things around.
I want to ask you, though, I mean, because we want to get to Hillary Clinton and some news for her this week, but there might be some conflict coming in the Trump campaign again, because, you know, we mentioned that Stephen Bannon, who's really on the top of the campaign, is a pit bull. Andrew Breitbart of Breitbart News was said to have admiringly called him the Leni Riefenstahl of the Tea Party movement. And this was a reference to Hitler's propaganda filmmaker. But then, surprise, we have this new Trump with this new tone that may be accredited to Kellyanne Conway, who was the pollster who was also brought in. Are we going to have two styles in conflict here, Jesse?
Well, here's the thing. This is a whiff of the pivot that the GOP has been waiting for Donald Trump to make since the Republican National Convention. During the primaries, Trump seemed willing to say anything at any time, regardless of how it affected anyone else. This is a hint of the candidate that the GOP wants him to be. Now, he's made these little overtures toward being what the GOP wants as his presidential candidate before, only to reverse his stance a day later or 2 days later and go back to his Trump being Trump movement. But the question is, will he be able to sustain this? Will he be baited 2 days from now from a tweet from someone else, or will he go off teleprompter again and say things that will bring more attention, sometimes negative attention, to his campaign?
Well, and Jesse, will he be able to do well with a group that he hasn't? He suddenly started speaking last night, making overtures to African-American voters.
A group he does very poorly with, by the way.
Exactly. Here's the question that no one can answer quite yet. Is it too late? Now, you have all these statements he's made about Mexicans. You had all these statements he's made about women that have been out there for months now, saying now that we're less than 3 months away from the election, I'm sorry, I offended you. Will that make a difference in the mind of some voters? It may for some, but it's really hard to see that making a huge difference between now and the election.
Well,
the election.
I think Margaret, let's talk about Hillary Clinton, because we want to make sure that we spend enough time on both candidates. The Clinton Foundation says that if Hillary Clinton wins, Bill Clinton will resign from the board of the foundation and they'll stop accepting foreign donations. Some people, some Republicans especially, have called for shutting down the Clinton Foundation altogether if Hillary Clinton wins. What do you make of all this, Margaret?
I think if they would have done this 6 months ago or a year ago, it would have largely taken the issue off the table. And like is often the case in the Clinton campaign, she'll wait and wait and wait and wait and then wait and wait some more and then finally do something and get less bump out of it than she could have to begin with. But the Clintons recognize that, particularly with the staff shakeup on the Trump side, but even if it had just been Manafort staying on, the Clinton Foundation and the donations to it are going to increasingly, after Labor Day, become the subject of attack ads, attack lines, and campaign speeches, rhetoric attempting to cast this air of either sort of corruption or double dealing or mixed influence between office and the foundation. And they're attempting to head that off at the pass without having to kind of tear apart his legacy entirely.
Well, Mario, what are you hearing from the campaign about the fact that the Trump campaign and actually Trump backers are actually just starting to spend some money on advertising? Stephen Bannon came with some big money backers, you know, who he's close with. Is that going to suddenly start having an impact? I'm seeing more anti-Clinton ads than I ever did before.
Well, you're starting to, but even so, the ad buys are behind, and some of them are interesting places, including traditional Republican places, rather than swing areas where you'd expect to see them competing. When you're looking at the ads that are up and running now, they tend to be ads that you might think would appeal to the base, and certainly not to the sort of a crossover segment of the election, talking about the dangers of illegal immigration across the Mexican border, this sort of thing. So, yes, you're starting to see ads, and a lot of what the Bannon and Conway era is supposed to usher in is more discipline, more structure, more battleground games. But, wow, it's like mid-August, right? Uh-huh. So, back to Jesse's question of whether it's too late, I think it's going to play in the ad world, too. Will these ads begin to broaden so that they're appealing more to the center?
Well, let's hear a little bit from Clinton herself. She was in a number of places campaigning this week, reiterating her economic message about helping the middle class. Of course, she also took some digs at Donald Trump. Well, here she is in Cleveland on Wednesday.
For anyone waiting for Donald Trump to suddenly become more responsible, remember what a great American, Maya Angelou, said. When someone shows you who they are, believe them.
She's like, she's anticipating what he did 2 days later, change his tone.
Right. And Jesse, I want to ask you, I mean, as this tone shifts on Donald Trump's side of things, what will Clinton have to do to either make up or adjust on adjust herself?
Well, this is one of the interesting things that's going on, that Hillary Clinton hasn't had to do much. She's been able to sit back and watch Donald Trump dominate the news cycle in negative ways, that she hasn't had to go out and give press conferences. She hasn't had to do interviews with the media. So if Donald Trump is actually doing the pivot into becoming the Republican presidential nominee that they want out there, it'll be incumbent on Clinton to actually step up her efforts. Because keep in mind, neither one of them has really great reputation around the entire country. She's been able to, frankly, coast since the Democratic National Convention because Trump and the escapades on the Republican side have dominated the news cycle. If he's going to actually tone down and read from the teleprompter and stay on script, it's now on Hillary Clinton to go back and again prove why she should be president instead of having to just say Donald Trump can't be president.
Jesse Holland from the Associated Press and Mark Attal of Bloomberg, senior White House correspondent. I know we say this just about every week, but people, the electorate is really just starting to pay attention. We've actually been saying that for months now, but we will all pay attention as we really head towards people coming out of summer and heading toward the election. Thank you both.
Thank you.
More reaction today to the Justice Department's decision to stop using private prison. Yesterday's move will affect 13 prisons, which house about 22,000 inmates. It's just about 11% of the federal prison population, and to put it in an even broader context, about 2 million inmates live in state and local prisons across the country. Still, many prison reform advocates say this is a monumental and symbolic step. Rashad Robinson is executive director of Color of Change, a national racial justice organization, and he's with us from New York. And Rashad, what do you make of this? Is it more than just symbolism from the Justice Department?
Well, I think this is an important step forward. You know, private prisons have a warped purpose. They've brought money and money making into the system of justice in our country. And private prisons have a warped incentive structure. And so I think it's an important step. It gives us the ability to take what the federal government has now done and move that into our conversations and advocacies in states. The real issue, though, is that we need to not just have this as a one-time thing, but we need Congress to firm this up by passing legislation so that this is not just something that happens during this administration.
Well, speaking of advocacy, your organization has encouraged corporations to divest money from the industry. You've pushed Hillary Clinton to stop taking donations from private prison lobbyists. You've pushed the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice to cancel its contracts. But what do you think? I mean, will this move by the Justice Department push states in the same direction? You mentioned Congress, but what about states? Because that's where the bulk of these prisoners are.
Absolutely. And we do think that this is an important step forward. We also understand that the ongoing human rights violations that keep coming up from these private prisons because of their warped incentive structure gives us the ability to say to states that they've been warned, that the federal government has looked deeply, they've done research, and they've seen that this type of relationship doesn't work. And so to the extent that now that states have been sent a very clear message from the federal government, we think it's going to give us strength in many states that we think will have advocacy. We also understand that this is going to continue to weaken an industry that at every turn cuts corners. And so as this industry continues to get weakened, as we've seen its stocks continue to fall since this announcement, we think that it's going to give us more ability to be able to put an end to private prisons and this idea that profit should be inside of our justice system.
Well, Rashad, it's probably no surprise the industry disagrees with you. A spokesman for the Corrections Corporation of America said the Inspector General's report that contributed to this decision had significant flaws, also said that the findings just don't match up to the numerous independent studies that show, and I'm quoting here, our facilities to be equal or better with regard to safety and quality. And a spokesman for another private company said to base this decision on cost, safety, and security is just wrong. So I just want to ask you, do you think that a government-run prison really would be that much better than a private prison?
Well, I think that there are absolutely problems with some of our government-run prisons, but the fact of the matter is that we have much more control and oversight over those prisons. We can't even do a Freedom of Information Act to get real information and data on private prisons because they are exempt, even though so many of our tax dollars are going to those private prisons. For the private prison industry to say that cost and security shouldn't be a factor in whether or not these contracts are renewed is absolutely laughable. laughable and speaks to the flawed incentive structures that these corporations have. These corporations have spent millions and millions of dollars lobbying on Capitol Hills in states around the country and federally to keep these businesses in place, all the while cutting corners. It's not just this study, but it's been study after study. It's been internal investigations by journalists at Mother Jones and Nation Magazine and others. Over and over again, we see that this system simply doesn't work. It doesn't work for people, you know, who are paying taxes. It doesn't work for people who are inside the system. They have no incentive whatsoever to rehabilitate, right? The profit margins of private prisons relies on beds being filled. And so they not just lobby for their own contracts, but they lobby for things like mandatory minimum sentences, like increased sentencing for drug offenses. They have an incentive to see more people in our country behind bars and less people living prosperous and healthy lives. And when a business is based on that, that business is bad for America.
Well, clearly some people agree with you, many people perhaps, and maybe there are problems, but what is the alternative then? There are a lot of people out there who are living in prisons. We've got to put them somewhere. If you could design a federal prison system that would be better, what would it look like?
Well, I think a federal system that would look better would be really focused on rehabilitation. It would be focused on ensuring that people got the tools that they needed to be able to live healthy lives. For folks that couldn't live in society, that the system would be set up in a humane way, but people would also be given the tools to be productive when possible, that families would be able to find ways to be connected still with their loved ones, because we've seen study after study about how young people being connected, even with their family members behind bars, strengthens their life outcomes. And so we do think that there are ways in which we can have incarceration that is both humane and that is also cost effective. And private prisons don't do either one of those things. We also just think that we've over-incarcerated in this country. The war on drugs, our sentencing structure has put people behind bars who should be treated for other things, whether it's mental health or drug addictions. People should be given second chances. We continue to see incarceration as a first resort instead of a last resort in so many places around the country. And we've got to rethink that if we're going to get the best out of all of our citizens.
Well, it will be a big job if this is to follow in other states and in other departments within the federal government. Rashad Robinson, Executive Director of Color of Change, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And as we said, the Department of Justice decision does not include private, state, and local prisons. Also worth noting that it doesn't do anything for Immigration and Customs Enforcement centers along the U.S. border. Those are used to detain people who came into this country illegally. So we'll keep an eye on all this as it develops. Now, it's standard medical care for newborn babies to get a shot of vitamin K. It helps their blood clot and prevents potentially dangerous bleeding. But some new parents are declining the shots for their babies, and that's got doctors very worried. Carrie Goldberg from Here and Now contributor WBUR reports.
The baby was born full term and healthy, but a few weeks later was limp and unresponsive, barely breathing.
This baby was diagnosed with bleeding in the brain, and babies that suffer intracranial bleeding or bleeding in the brain unfortunately have damage that is often lifelong.
Dr. Ivana Kulik is a neonatologist, a specialist in newborns at Boston Children's Hospital.
Personally, it is actually really hard to take care of any infant that is sick. But when you realize severe illness was completely preventable, then that is something that is very difficult for everyone to comprehend and deal with.
The child survived, but medical privacy rules bar Kulik from revealing more details about this case. But she could say this. The parents of the baby had refused the standard shot of vitamin K.
If the baby is given vitamin K injection at birth, this virtually eliminates possibility of this kind of bleeding happening.
There's no national tracking of vitamin K refusals, but in recent years, anecdotal reports from hospitals and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have described clusters of several babies who had brain bleeds and whose parents had declined the vitamin K shot. Dr. Robert Sidonio Jr. of Emory University documented one such cluster in Nashville, Tennessee in 2013. 5 babies with brain bleeds over 6 months. It turned out, he says, that more than 3% of Nashville parents were declining vitamin K shots. And in nearby communities with birthing centers, nearly 30% were declining the vitamin K shot.
And this isn't a relatively, you know, medium-sized city that tends to be relatively conservative. And so that was sort of shocking to us that there were that many parents declining it. It was quite shocking to the CDC as well.
Dr. Ben Wheeler of the University of Otago in New Zealand has just published the first in-depth look at what motivates parents who decline the vitamin K shot for their newborns. Data from interviews with 15 families, published in the Journal of Medical Ethics, found a range of factors, from religious beliefs to the conviction that natural is better.
You know, we believe God created us and knew what he was doing.
Is one thing Wheeler heard from parents.
Other ones such as if baby really needed more vitamin K, they'd get it from me.
Some of it is based on not wanting to have the baby have that pain.
Dr. Christy Waterberg chairs the Committee on Newborns of the American Academy of Pediatrics. She says some parents are just misinformed.
I think that people have to be more careful. There are so many things on the internet that are absolutely not true. They have no basis in fact.
Doctors need to be sure to provide better information in a personal way, says neonatologist Dr. Ivana Kulik.
We should always try to ask parents why are they trying to refuse it, try to alleviate the fears and explain where the misunderstanding is, and try our best not to let this happen.
Dr. Kulik says the sort of bleed she saw is rare, but when it happens, when a baby goes from healthy at birth to severely ill, it can be a nightmare. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
The Olympics wrap up this weekend with the American team leading the overall medal count over Great Britain and China. One of the main reasons for the lead is the performance by the U.S. athletes in track and field. It has been a tremendous meet for American track and field stars. Here now is Alex Ashlock reports.
4 years ago, the U.S. won 29 track and field medals in London. Heading into this final weekend in Rio, the American team has 25 medals, 9 gold, 8 silver, and 8 bronze. One of those gold medals belongs to this man.
He'll come across the line, the world's greatest athlete, 2-time Olympic champion Ashton Eaton.
Tom Hammond with the call on NBC last night as Ashton Eaton finished his 1,500-meter run and sealed his place in Olympic history. Eaton, who also won gold in London 4 years ago, did not break the world record for points in the grueling 10-event competition, but he did tie an Olympic record. Ryan Crouser set an Olympic record in one of the field events. He won gold in the shot put with an effort that surpassed 73 feet. Also in the field in Rio, Christian Taylor and Willie Clay won gold and silver in the triple jump, just like they did in London 4 years ago. Jeff Henderson captured gold in the long jump, and Tiana Bartoletta and Brittany Reese won gold and silver in the women's long jump. On the track, steeplechasers Emma Coburn and Evan Jagger won medals in the 3,000-meter race, Coburn the bronze, Jagger the silver. Those were the first medals for Americans in that event since 1984. In fact, Coburn's medal was the first ever by an American woman in the steeplechase. Journalist Phil Hirsch has covered 18 Olympics. He's the former Olympic writer for the Chicago Tribune.
Clearly, the gold medal dam burst, at least on the track part, when Brianna Rollins won the hurdles the other night on the U.S. women's swept, which was the first sweep ever for U.S. women in a single track event. Prior to that, the field athletes had been doing great. You had the long jump with Henderson, the women's shot put with Michelle Carter, the triple jump with Christian Taylor winning gold. And then once the hurdlers broke through, then you added the Dalila Muhammad and the women's 400 hurdles, Karan Clement and the men's. Overall, I think it's a better performance than anybody expected from from what we saw at the U.S. Olympic trials. It's been kind of like USA swimming, where their Olympic trials performances did not produce a lot of world-leading times, but they had a spectacular performance in Rio.
In addition to those performances, there has also been a strong showing for the U.S. in middle distance running in Rio. Jenny Simpson won bronze in the 1500 meters, the first American medal ever in that event. And Clayton Murphy surged down the home stretch. He took home the bronze in the men's 800. This weekend holds more chances for American medals in the relays and the men's 1500 and women's 800. There are also two veterans making what will likely be their final appearances on the Olympic stage. 41-year-old Bernard Lagat is in the 5,000-meter final tomorrow night up against the Great Britain runner Mo Farah, and 41-year-old Meb Keflezighi runs the marathon on Sunday morning. What we're seeing this week is a demonstration of how athletes target their training for the Olympics every 4 years, and it's paying off with some peak performances on the world's biggest stage. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
And we will all be watching this weekend and then closing ceremonies Sunday night. Bill Lee was a great southpaw, a lefty pitcher with his own version of the Ephus, the loopy curveball Lee called the Leafus, but his stats are often overshadowed by his stunts. He came to the Boston Red Sox in 1969 from a California baseball family, a dope-smoking, philosopher-quoting, left-leaning leprechaun they called the Spaceman. He was a fiercely loyal player rep who called his manager a gerbil, was traded from the Sox after a walkout in support of one player, booted from the Montreal Expos after a mini-strike for another. A new film starts there, with Lee fighting to get back into the big leagues as he starts playing with the amateurs in Canada, convincing them to try his marijuana-infused style. Here, actor Josh Duhamel plays Lee, describing pitching while high.
On the mound. That is where I channeled the light. I combined the sacrifice of Jesus with the patience of Buddha. And then mixed in the control of Sandy Koufax just to get a little Judaism in there. I was Vishnu in a polyester V-neck.
Vishnu in a polyester V-neck. Lee went on to play with the semi-pros, the Masters Senior Baseball League. In 2012, he became the oldest pitcher to pitch a pro game with the San Rafael California Pacifics. Now 70, he's settled in Vermont, where he's running for governor. He ran for president in 1988 as part of the Canadian Rhinoceros Party, part of their platform, leveling the Rocky Mountains to give more sunlight to Alberta. The film Spaceman is based on Lee's book, The Wrong Stuff. He joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hello again.
Okay, so we're trying to explain what you were like as a player. So here's a story from a midday Red Sox game in the 1970s. You were pitching. I was working for a local TV station, and we heard over the radio that runner Billy Rogers was going to win the Boston Marathon. So I start running from the Fenway over to the end of the finish line, and I hear this noise behind me, like this clicking on the ground. And I turn around, and it's you in your cleats. You're the pitcher. And you're also running over to see Billy Rogers win.
Yes, I'd been knocked out of the game. I hated pitching the 11 o'clock game. I was always taking it on the chin because I was just sobering up by then.
During the game, you ran to go see the finish of the marathon. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So what, though, do you think, Billy? You just said sober up. And you start the film talking about how you love the fans in Montreal, your character saying they'd shower me with tiny foil balls of hash in the bullpen.
13 grams, first game I ever pitched.
Lower down bottles of tequila.
Yes.
So is this a story, are you a story of a self-destructive addict who couldn't handle authority, or is it a story, are you a story of a free spirit who refused to conform and stood up for others, even to your detriment?
Well, the end justifies the means, and at 67, I threw a complete game in professional baseball. At 61, I beat the rookie team for the UCLA Bruins up in Alaska in the Midnight Sun game. I have continued to dominate in the MSBL. I'm probably the winningest pitcher in the history of baseball outside of Satchel Paige. So does the end justify the means or the means justify the ends?
Okay, I'll come back at you. You lost custody of your kids, broke your heart.
Right.
You lost your first marriage. You lost baseball. You're driving people crazy and you're driving them away.
I just had two of my A's, Andy and Anna, here for the Yankee series. All my other kids are doing fine. My present wife, during Thanksgiving, gets everybody together, the whole family in Mississippi, and we have a reunion. And she makes all of my ex-wives cry, and they all realize that they did love me. Yeah, I'm a child. I wake up every morning as though I'm 7 years old, and that gets me out of bed, gets me going. And yeah, I'll drink a growler of beer in a heartbeat. And they made a whole show about me. It was called Cheers. You know that, don't you? But it's the game that's important, stupid. I say it's I get ready and get ready for the ball game. I coach. I bring 17 teams from the United States and Canada to Cuba during the winter. And then I bring three select teams from Cuba back to America and Canada. And I serenade them during the summer. So if I am the wrong stuff, I'd like to see the owners prove it. I was blackballed from Major League Baseball because I stuck up for Bernie Carbo and then for Rodney Scott. But that wasn't the main reason. They used that as an excuse because I'm the guy who made all the millionaires. Every player rep, as Marvin Miller said, when there was a transition or a strike, the player reps were the ones that were punished because we're the messenger. And I took all the money from the billionaire owners and redistributed it with the players. That's why I'm the most hated person in organized baseball. I am the Bernie Sanders of baseball.
You'd like to be, in some way, the Bernie Sanders of Vermont, I know, running for governor.
We're going to keep everybody from leaving the state because the main prophecy of the Republicans is that people are leaving and we don't have our youth there. We're going to make hemp. We're going to legalize it. We're going to make hemp uniforms. And I'm going to ban Bud Light. That's my first job because it litters the highways. It litters our Skidoo trails. It litters our cross-country ski trails that parallel our Skidoo trails. You remember the group Fair Share? We started the bottle bill here in Massachusetts. You're looking at the one guy that started recycling in America.
You are also lucky that you are not dead, given the hard life
It's a good day to die, grandfather. Little big man.
And one of your many habits, quoting constantly. When you watch the film.
Yes.
When you watch that part.
Very uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, here's a scene from the film Spaceman where a hungover Bill Lee, playing now in the amateurs, calls his estranged wife to see his kids.
You know, I'm starting tomorrow night's game. Thought maybe you could bring the kids by, watch the old man pitch again.
Oh, I don't know. You know, they have so much homework. It's tough during the week.
Well, I can pick them up from school. And I thought maybe afterwards, you know, maybe you and I could...
I really don't think it's a good idea, Bill.
They're just getting used to the adjustment. Maybe next time. Look, if you really want to spend more time with them, Andy's been asking me all week if you can come to one of his games. He's pitching now.
They can bring their homework to the ballpark, all right? Just, please, just bring them by.
Bill.
Yeah.
Good luck.
So, Billy, you say... Yes, that's uncomfortable. And then there are other scenes of you tilting at windmills. Is there anything else that made you uncomfortable? A charismatic character. You always were. But, you know...
No, you can please some of the people some of the time and some of the people all the time, but you can't please all the people all the time.
What would you say to young people watching this movie? You know, yeah, you know, maybe strike out on your own, be your own man, but not everyone survives the alcohol we see you take in. And you tell me that's overblown.
I don't do it that much. You know why? Because I can't perform the way I do every Sunday and every week playing ball. I just happen to have the best genes on the planet Earth. Yeah. And I was blessed with that. My grandmother was 99, broke her femur when she slid into second at 47 years of age. Her daughter's in the Hall of Fame. My grandfather on my maternal side lived to be 99, died in a car wreck. You know, I'm just a blessed person, and I'm lucky, and I've got great genes.
How times have changed. Here you are when the expos drop you. You and your children and a friend are sitting typing out on a typewriter letters to all the other teams. There wasn't really the big agentry there is now. You're sending out letters asking if someone can pick you up. You did do that.
We wrote letters only to the National League because I would not play in the American League because they wouldn't let me hit.
You wouldn't be allowed to hit.
You know, I have my principles.
But when you watch the game now, what do you think?
Hit the cutoff, man. Work faster. Throw strikes. Learn how to change speeds. If Lester knew how to pitch to the outside part of the plate, he'd have already won 300 games. You know, and Price, he's the same thing. They're all trying to throw the ball through a brick wall.
Red Sox pitchers,
instead of changing speeds and controlling space and time, which I did.
Are you really a Buddhist?
Yeah.
Unattached to results?
Yeah. I have no beginning, no end. I just exist.
Well, we have to have an end to this segment. Billy, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. Good to see you again.
You too. That's Bill Spaceman Lee. The new movie Spaceman, starring Josh Duhamel, opens today. Check your listings. And we have clips at hereandnow.org. By the way, Bill mentioned that the TV show Cheers was based on him, while the character of bartender Sam Malone certainly was. And he was also the muse for musicians. Here's a little of Warren Zevon's 1980 song, Billy. When I'm standing in the middle of the diamond all alone, I always pray to win when it comes to skin and bone. And sometimes I say things I shouldn't, like... We'll have that song and another by They Might Be Giants at hereandnow.org.
Millions of American households don't have access to a broadband computer connection, which has been an issue on the campaign trail. Here's Hillary Clinton talking about it.
It's astonishing to me how many places in America, not way, way far away from cities, but in cities and near cities, that don't have access to broadband. And that disadvantages kids who are asked to do homework using the internet. 5 million of them live in homes without access to the internet. So you talk about an achievement gap, it starts right there.
Now, some schools do give students laptops or iPads, but that doesn't help kids if they can't do homework or talk online with their teachers and classmates. We're joined now by Edward Lee Vargas. He's Executive Vice President of AVID. It's a nonprofit working to close the achievement gap. And Dr. Vargas, how big a problem is this?
Well, when you think about it, Peter, the public schools are the backbone of our democracy. They were created to educate a nation of citizens who could be literate, think, and participate, and compete. So when we have students who don't have access to the internet, it becomes a fundamentally a civil rights issue because we're denying them access to an equitable education.
You know, as someone who's been out of school for a while now, I think and most adults today probably didn't have internet growing up at home. But times, of course, have changed. Just explain to me on a really tangible level, how much more difficult does it make learning if you don't have the internet at your home?
Well, nowadays, it's all about not just memorizing information, but being able to access in real time. And when young people don't have that access in real time, it puts them at a tremendous disadvantage because you need to be able to access all of that knowledge and information
access
on
what?
The internet.
Access what? Are we talking about access to help with a math problem, access to a poem for an English class or something? What are you talking about access?
All of that and more when you think about all of the different applications that are available now to help students in all the various content areas, whether it's critical reading, writing, literature, information, to be able to compare and contrast and think critically. As our society transforms itself and technology becomes even more and more a part of our everyday living experience, it's really critical that our young people have access to that knowledge and information in real time.
And it breaks down by income. According to Pew, 31% of households earning less than $50,000 don't have access to the internet. And as you've alluded to, this is another way that the cycle of income inequality is entrenched into the economy.
Absolutely. And we know that education is the key to breaking that cycle of poverty.
Well, you've worked in many school districts, one in Washington State that gave out laptops to kids and tried other strategies to help try and solve the problem. What worked? And again, let's get down on a really tangible level here. What actually worked to help close this gap?
Well, basically, and you think about the district I was in, fourth largest in Washington State, with 138 languages spoken in the school district, that mirrors the future workforce. And having young people with these devices, one-on-one devices, with the connectivity not only at school but at home, we put what they call digital kiosks and hotspots in low-income housing, those types of things, so that when students got home, they could continue the learning, do their homework, accelerate their learning. And it had a tremendous impact in terms of the success of our students. We went from a 67% graduation rate in 2009 to a 92% graduation rate in 2014.
And how does it work, those kiosks that you mentioned putting into the public housing complexes? Just a public computer portal that people could come up to as if they were at school and do some of their homework?
Yeah, basically we partnered with our business community, and it was like a digital hotspot. Within the building that the young people were living in, they could access the internet just as though they were in school. And then what the business community did is they advertised on screens above the kiosk, so actually parents and kids could come up to those and find information about the school, classes, homework, that type of thing. But most importantly, it provided broadband access to students when they were not in school.
You mentioned private businesses getting involved. I wonder, though, if this is not a problem that the federal government should be solving. There is a program. It's called the Lifeline, and it does give low-income families subsidies for broadband. But is that the right policy solution? Should the federal government and state governments be doing more to solve the problem?
Well, when you think about public education being the responsibility of states and our government, and internet and broadband access being a fundamental part of that educational experience, absolutely. And I think it takes not only the community and what you were referencing in terms of the government, but also all the stakeholders who have a stake in this enterprise and the future of our country and the well-being of our young people.
That's Edward Lee Vargas. He's the executive vice president of AVID. It's a nonprofit group working on college readiness and closing the achievement gap. Dr. Vargas, thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
And Peter, in the coming weeks, we're going to take a closer look at inequity and how it affects kids. So we want to ask listeners, if you've got some thoughts, let us know, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Jeremy Hobson and I will be broadcasting from a national park starting on Monday.
Which one?
I'm not going to tell you. You're listening to Here and Now.